hold to the statute, that its unconstitutionality, like once it's pulled out, the whole house of cards collapses. And the presumption is always in favor of severability. It's a question of your intent. The court looks... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
The main thing is the doctrine of severability has a presumption to save the statute if possible. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So I want every conservative in the nation to listen to what she just said. The doctrine of severability presumes, and its goal is to preserve the statute if that is possible. So from a conservative point of view, the generally speaking, we want legislative bodies to make laws, not judges. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And would it be further true that if you can preserve a statute, you try to the extent possible?
That is true.
Okay. That's the law, folks. Abortion. You were read some statements by, I think it's St. What's the name of the pro-life group, county?
The St. Joseph County Right to Life.
Okay. And you were asked by Senator Blumenthal, who I respect, whether or not their policy positions were illegal. Do you remember that?
I remember him asking me whether I accepted other policy positions on in vitro fertilization and whether it was a rejection of Roe.
Yeah. Well, I remember a exchange where they took a statement from that group or some other group arguing for the criminalization.
Okay.
Remember that? The criminalization of IBF, is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. And here's my problem with that analysis. That was a position taken by a pro-life county organization. It's not your job to pass judgment on the thoughts and beliefs of Americans, is it, as a Supreme Court justice?
No, it is not.
So when they argue that something should be criminal, they have a right to make that argument, right?
They do. It also wasn't in the ad that appeared next to the statement I saw.
The main thing is, how does something become criminal in our legal system in America?
When a legislative body passes a statute.
So here's what I want you to know. Statements by political organizations are not law. And what we've tried to do yesterday was turn a pro-life group into a legislative body and tried to get you to rule on their beliefs. I think that is a dangerous thing for Americans to be asking a judge to do, whether you're on the right or the left. Here's a statement from an organization I don't particularly agree with, and I want you to pass judgment as to whether or not that's legal. The question for you would be, if some legislative body tried to criminalize this procedure, then that would be subject to litigation in court. Is that correct?
That is correct.
A case in controversy doesn't arise because you disagree with a statement of a private person or a private group. Is that correct?
That is correct.
A case in controversy arises around criminal law when somebody passes a criminal statute. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Then and only then would you determine the constitutionality of that provision. Is that correct?
Well, actually, not even then. The statute would have to be enforced against somebody, so a prosecutor would have to try to hold someone criminally liable for getting IVF, for example.
So the case in controversy concept would have to mature.
Yes, there would be quite a lot of maturation required.
Yeah, before it got to the Supreme Court, if it ever did. So I just want every American to know it's not the role of Supreme Court justice to pass judgment on your opinions. It's the role of a Supreme Court justice in very limited circumstances to pass judgment on laws passed by legislative bodies and in other circumstances, regulation, I would suppose. Now, voting. Is it appropriate for legislative bodies to protect the integrity of the ballot box?
So any specific measures that legislative bodies took to protect the integrity of the ballot box could be subject to litigation, subject to challenge.
And that's so, right. And as they are developed, the courts will hear cases and controversies arise, right?
Yes.
One of the reasons we don't have an agreement with the House is in their $2.2 trillion package, they're mandating ballot harvesting as a national policy. I think it's ripe for fraud. We've seen evidence of ballots being placed in people's cars and dropped in ditches. So I think there will be an effort, I hope, to protect the integrity of the ballot and also ensure easy voting. I don't think they're contrary goals for the nation. Now, when it comes to being on the court itself and collaborating with other members of the court, what's your experience been at the Seventh Circuit level? How's that played out?
It is so collegial. We all collaborate. I have the greatest respect and have had wonderful interactions with every single one of my colleagues.
Do you think you have the capability to fit in at the Supreme Court?
I hope so.
Okay. So we talked a lot about laws legalizing same-sex marriage. What's the name of the case?
Obergefell.
Okay. And you would, if anybody tried to change that precedent, one of the things you would look at is a reliance interest that people have formed around that piece of legislation?
Yes.
Same with Casey and Roe?
Yes.
Okay. So reaching a decision that the case was wrongly decided doesn't end the debate in terms of whether or not it should be repealed. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And there is a very rigorous process in place to overturn precedent?
There is, many factors, reliance being one.
Okay. Is there any constitutional right to a polygamous relationship?
Let's see. That might be a question that could be litigated at, you know, polygamy, obviously, in many places is illegal now, but that could be an issue somebody might litigate before the court at some point.
Yeah, somebody might make the argument it's possible for three people to love each other genuinely, and that would work its way to the court if somebody wanted to make that argument. Is that correct?
Somebody could, yeah, make that argument.
So you've been asked a lot about Roe v. Wade and Casey, and one of the differences between Brown versus Board of Education and Roe line of cases is there's active litigation regarding Roe. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I think Senator Hirano named 8 or 9 different cases that may come up to the court, cases in controversy. And one of the reasons you can't tell us how you would rule is because there's active litigation coming to the court. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And one of the reasons you can say with confidence that you think Brown versus Board of Education is super precedent is that you're not aware of any effort to go back to the good old days of segregation by a legislative body. Is that correct?
That is correct. I've also said that in lectures that Brown was correct as an original matter. So that is the kind of thing, since I've said it in writing, I felt like I could express before the committee.
When it comes to Heller, there's legislative bodies all over the country passing laws regarding gun ownership. Are you aware of that?
I am aware of that.
Okay. When it comes to Citizens United, I think there'll be some efforts after this election to maybe revisit that case. So the thing that I'm trying to establish here is that Heller, Citizens United, Roe, Casey are all actively being litigated because legislative bodies are playing in that arena. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement.
So your point to us is when it's likely that case and controversies around the holding of a particular case are going to come to the court, there's only so much you can tell us about what you may or may not do.
Absolutely.
So that Roe v. Wade compared to Brown versus Board of Education is not super precedent.
Not super precedent, as I was using that term in the articles that have been referred to.
And let me tell you from a common sense point of view why it's not super precedent. I have legislation. 14 states have passed a law that I'm trying to get passed up here, that in the 5th month of pregnancy, 20 weeks, an unborn child is capable of feeling pain. I'm making the argument there's a compelling state interest to protect that unborn child from a very painful death called abortion. There's only 7 nations on the entire planet that allow abortion on demand in the 5th month. Now, that's a political exercise we're going through. 14 states have passed a version of what I've just described. That will be coming to the court, I would imagine, in the future. All I ask is, will you listen to both sides of the argument if it gets to you?
I will.
Thank you. Judge, all I can say, I've met a lot of people in this business and very impressive people. One of the highlights of my time on the committee is to get to meet incredibly talented, smart, squared away people. Justice Roberts sat right before you and didn't have a note. A lot of people on my side are upset with him about this or that. Sometimes I disagree with him, but I do know this, that he's doing what he thinks is best for the court and for the country. Justice Sotomayor and Kagan, delightful people, incredibly, wickedly smart. Justice Kagan had a biting sense of humor, and they're on the court because they should be. They're on the court because they live lives worthy of being on the court. They're on the court because they're some of the smartest people in the land about the law. They're on the court because they lived incredibly productive and meaningful lives. Justice Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are both on the court for the same reasons. As to you, you're every bit in their league. In my view, this is exactly where you should be going to the Supreme Court, that the United States of America will benefit from your participation at the Supreme Court. You will offer a point of view that millions of Americans share. You will have life experiences that will round out the court. You will apply the law to the facts, and that you are going to inspire a lot of young women, just like Justice Ginsburg did, just like Justice Sotomayor and Kagan did, and the young women that you're going to inspire don't have a whole lot of role models they can point to in terms of the media world in which we live in, uplifting them. That's about to change. To my Democratic colleagues, I understand where you're coming from. I understand what you want the court to do. You want the court to do things differently than we do. I don't question your motives, and I want to thank you for conducting this hearing in a way that has been respectful, has been challenging, and the process will be moving forward here. And from the committee's point of view, I think we're on track to do it in a way that hopefully people will say, even though you disagree strongly, you're not that disagreeable. Senator Feinstein.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman.
The ranking Democratic member, Judge, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California.
I'm delighted to see your family here again, and I hope they feel that very special sense of pride in you. I'm sure they do. And I think, you know, I was thinking of my children and grandchildren, and this is really a once-in-a-lifetime occasion. So I hope they find it very special in their lives.
Thank you, Senator.
You're welcome. Yesterday, you spoke of California v. Texas, the current case seeking to strike down the Affordable Care Act. You said, I think, that the issue before the court is severability, meaning whether the court can still uphold the Affordable Care Act if it rules that the individual mandate is unconstitutional. And you said yesterday this question was not before the court. As I understand this, Chief Justice Roberts and the majority did involve the issue of severability in a case known as the NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business, v. Sebelius. There, the Chief Justice and the 5-4 majority that included Justice Ginsburg struck down one part of the law, the Medicaid expansion provision, but allowed the rest of the law to stand because they found it was severable from the portion they struck down. Justice Scalia dissented from this conclusion, stated that, quote, the unconstitutionality of the individual mandate and the Medicaid expansion requires the invalidation of the Affordable Care Act's other provisions, end quote. In other words, the justice believed that the law was not severable and the entire law had to be struck down, including provisions protecting people with pre-existing conditions. You have been close to the justices' philosophy, and in these hearings, you've also said that this doesn't mean you would reach all the same conclusions. So can you explain to us today how you would disagree or agree with Justice Scalia's view of severability in that NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business case?
Well, what I think I can say without expressing disagreement or agreement for the reasons I said yesterday, not being able to grade precedents, the severability issue, first of all, the majority holding, as you recognized, was that even though the Medicaid provision was unconstitutional, it was severable. So Justice Scalia expressed his view in dissent. Even by Justice Scalia's view, the issue would be different in California versus Texas for two reasons. One, Justice Scalia thought two provisions of the Constitution were unconstitutional. So if you picture severability being like a Jenga game, it's kind of if you pull one out, can you pull it out while it all stands? Or if you pull two out, will it still stand? So Justice Scalia, his view was that if you pulled those two provisions out, could it still stand? And here we're talking about one. And also, Congress has amended the statute since NFIB versus Sebelius, and it zeroed out the mandate. So now, California versus Texas involves a different provision because of the zeroing out that was done by amendment. So that's how the two cases present slightly different issues.
What do you think of all that?
What do I think of? Yeah. Of severability? Or
in that instance?
I think the doctrine of severability, as it's been described by the court, you know, serves a valuable function of trying not to undo your work when you wouldn't want a court to undo your work. Severability strives to look at a statute as a whole and say, would Congress have considered this provision so vital that kind of in the Jenga game, pulling it out, Congress wouldn't want the statute anymore? So it's designed to effectuate your intent. But, you know, severability is designed to say, well, would Congress still want the statute to stand even with this provision gone? Would Congress have still passed the same statute without it? So I think insofar as it tries to effectuate what Congress would have wanted, it's the court and Congress working hand in hand.
Thank you. That's quite a definition. I'm really impressed. Thank you. Some have argued that the Medicare program is unconstitutional. It's an unconstitutional exercise in congressional spending power. They believe that the spending power does not exist at all. In talking about Medicare and Social Security, Professor Mike Rappaport of the University of San Diego Law wrote this: "It is worth remembering that these programs would never have taken their pernicious form if the Constitution's original meaning had been followed in the first place." Do you agree with originalists who say that the Medicare program is unconstitutional? And if so, why?
I'm not familiar with that article by Professor Rappaport, so I don't know what reasoning he advances for claiming that the spending power as exercised in things like the Medicaid provision would be unconstitutional.
Well, it's in Law and Liberty, July 23rd, 2015. But the question is, do you agree with originalists who say that the Medicare program is unconstitutional?
Well, let's see. So I think I can't answer that question in the abstract, you know, because as we've talked about the no hints, no forecasts, no previews rule, I also don't know what the arguments would be. So I assume Professor Rappaport lays out a case, but it's not a question that I've ever considered before. But if I did consider it, it would be in the context of an actual case or controversy.
Well, I thank you. It's hard for me to believe that that's a real question, because I think the Medicare program is really sacrosanct in this country. But let me ask you, last April, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Supreme Court prevented Wisconsin from implementing a district court order that would have extended the state's deadline for submitting absentee ballots. This would have given voters greater flexibility in casting absentee ballots for Wisconsin's primary election. Justice Ginsburg dissented, She criticized the court's majority for putting its head in the sand with regard to the risks posed by COVID-19. She emphasized that courts and election officials must be able to react to a grave, rapidly developing public health crisis. And she noted that the Supreme Court's, quote, suggestion that the current situation is not substantially different from an ordinary election boggles the mind, end quote. Would you agree, and what is your position?
Well, Senator Feinstein, that's obviously a very recent case. And, you know, in that case, the court had to address, you know, the constitutional question. And so, again, it's one of those things that I can't answer, both because it would be requiring me to grade and express agreement or disagreement with the Supreme Court opinion, but also it's the kind of case that could come up in a closely related form, either on the Seventh Circuit, you know, Wisconsin is within the Seventh Circuit's jurisdiction, or on the Supreme Court.
Okay, let me try again with something. After President Trump announced your nomination to the Supreme Court, you discussed the judicial philosophy of the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Specifically, you stated, his judicial philosophy is mine. During oral arguments in the 2013 case Shelby County v. Holder, Justice Scalia questioned the strong congressional support for reenactment of the Voting Rights Act. He argued that this support was not attributable to the fact that we need the Voting Rights Act. Rather, he stated that he believed Congress reenacted the bill due to a, quote, phenomenon that's called perpetuation of racial entitlement, end quote. What is your your reading of this and your understanding of the history of the Voting Rights Act?
Well, when I said that Justice Scalia's philosophy is mine too, I certainly didn't mean to say that every sentence that came out of Justice Scalia's mouth or every sentence that he wrote is one that I would agree with. When I said Justice Scalia's philosophy is mine too, what I meant is that his jurisprudential approach to text, as we've talked about originalism and textualism, is the same that I would take. And I think as for the Voting Rights Act, I think that it was obviously a triumph in the civil rights movement.
Well, the question arises in my mind, of course, my view is that we always need this. This is a bulwark of our democracy. So need, I think, is something that may be somewhat subjective. Do you agree with that?
That need is subjective?
Yes. Yeah, that I think we do need a Voting Rights Act, and it's subjective in that sense.
Well, I think, Senator Feinstein, the question of how the coverage formula is calculated and the Voting Rights Act and the contours of the Voting Rights Act and whether Shelby County was rightly decided or not are all questions on which I can't give an answer because Shelby County has obviously been controversial. It's likely to be relitigated. It could come up before me on the court.
Well, let me give you, because I think this is really important because it shows the basic philosophical bent of an individual. For me, the Voting Rights Act is extremely important, and it defines our election system to a great extent. It's hard for me to understand that anyone would want to do away with it. What is your position in that regard?
As I understand Shelby County, it said that the coverage formula was outdated from the 1960s for subjecting the particular states, requiring them to get preclearance. It's my understanding, and I haven't looked at the case in a while, that everything else about the Voting Rights Act remained intact, including its prohibitions on discrimination in elections. It was just the coverage formula which decided which states were subject to preclearance.
Well, let me ask you this question, and this is a hard one. Do you agree with Justice Scalia's assertion that the Voting Rights Act is a, quote, perpetuation of racial entitlement, end quote.
Senator Feinstein, I don't obviously know what Justice Scalia was thinking when he said that. And any characterization of the Voting Rights Act or a statement like that is simply really not something I can opine on because, you know, that's tied in, I would think, with these Shelby County questions.
Well, can you opine? I'm not asking for a formal opinion, but would you believe that it's a perpetuation of racial entitlement?
Well, Senator Feinstein, I think that goes to the question of whether the coverage formula was outdated and needed to be updated from the 1960s or not. I take that to be the thrust of the disagreement in Shelby County and the position that Justice Scalia was taking. So again, I can't express a view on Shelby County and whether the majority or dissent had the better of the argument.
Okay, let me move on to workers' rights and age discrimination. In a 2019 case, Kleber v. Care Fusion Corporation, you joined a majority of the Seventh Circuit judges in holding that age discrimination in employment does not protect job applicants against employment practices that have a disproportionately harmful impact on older applicants. The opinion you joined, as I understand it, dismissed a claim brought by a 58-year-old lawyer who was passed over for a job that was offered to a 29-year-old applicant with less experience. I think I'm concerned by the implications of the decision. According to AARP, approximately 35% of the United States population is now 50 years or older. Almost 29% of households are headed by someone near or past retirement age who have no savings or pension. According to the EEOC, study after study has shown age discrimination, quote, remains a significant barrier for older workers, end quote. And older applicants are more frequently denied job interviews than middle-aged applicants. Additionally, older and middle-aged women are subjected to more age discrimination than men. The EEOC has found that the Great Recession during President Bush's administration, quote, forced many older workers to revive their retirement plans, to work longer to recoup drained retirement accounts and lost savings. So here's the question, because I think it's going to be an increasing problem for the court. What do you understand to be the purpose of age discrimination, of the Age Discrimination in Employment Act?
Well, in Kleber versus Care Fusion, I joined a majority of the en banc court, so that was a case that we heard as a full court. And the question is whether the prohibition on age discrimination covered applicants or only employees. And the statute said employees, and so an applicant isn't an employee. So the majority said that the statute, by its terms, didn't cover the conduct. But I think that's an instance. You know, I talked yesterday quite a bit about whose role it is to update statutes or extend them. And I think that's an instance in which Congress could well address this problem by amending the statute to include applicants in it.
So where would you stand on the general subject matter?
Well, since I can't impose the law of Amy, that would be up to the Congress to decide, or many state legislatures have different anti-discrimination prohibitions that offer even more protection than some federal statutes.
Okay. Let's talk for a moment. In 2013, you wrote, and this is a quote, I tend to agree with those who say that a justice's duty is to the Constitution, and that it's thus more legitimate for her to enforce her best understanding of the Constitution rather than a precedent she thinks clearly conflicts with it. If you are presented with a case where your view of the Constitution conflicts with Supreme Court precedent. What will control your decision, your understanding of the Constitution or precedent?
Senator Feinstein, I'm really glad that you brought that up because that quote was mentioned a lot yesterday, and I'm happy to have an opportunity to explain the context. That entire article, I mean, I think that there's been some misunderstanding, perhaps because that sentence, first of all, it was citing a footnote to both an originalist scholar and a progressive constitutionalist. But the whole article was defending the Supreme Court's current doctrine, which accords constitutional precedent weaker stare decisis effect than, say, statutory precedent. And I mentioned that yesterday, against claims that we should have no doctrine of stare decisis at all, and against claims that it should be absolute and completely tie the court's hands. So I actually wasn't arguing for any alteration to stare decisis doctrine. I was saying this is how it is, this is how the Supreme Court does it, and that's right. And another couple of sentences in there, which I think might put my perspective in context, I said a new majority cannot impose its vision only with votes. It must, now I'm paraphrasing myself, it must be very sure that its interpretation of the Constitution is the right one and that reliance, interests, et cetera, don't counsel in favor of its overruling, paraphrased. And then the next sentence was something to the effect of an uncertainty in that regard counsels in favor of preserving the status quo. So that sentence, if it's just read alone, makes it sound like I'm arguing for the overthrow of stare decisis in constitutional cases altogether. But that wasn't the thrust of the article, quite to the contrary.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And we all welcome the fact that your family's here. It's a beautiful family.
Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Senator Grassley.
Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa now.
He's not ready. For $5, I won't stop starting the clock.
Judge,
start the clock.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Senator.
I want to compliment you for doing a very good job answering our questions and all about your decision-making process. You've been forthright, candid, thoughtful. You've demonstrated a tremendous command of and respect for the law and Constitution. You've shown us that your judicial method is rigorous, but also fair and open-minded. Above all, it's clear that you understand the appropriate role of a judge, just what we're looking for, at least on this side of the aisle. An individual who will interpret the law, not one to make it. You are an outstanding candidate. A couple things before I ask my questions. First, Judge, many of my colleagues on the other side have tried to get you to tell us how you rule on a case, whether you believe a case was correctly decided, or whether you'll commit to uphold a specific law. As you've responded, it is not appropriate for you or any nominee in your position, for any level of the judiciary, to make promises or give hints on how you'd rule or what you think about a potential issue that may come up. Judicial independence from the legislative and executive branch, those are our political branches accountable to the people, is a bedrock principle of our constitutional system. Justice Ginsburg said it best, a judge is sworn to decide impartially and can offer no forecasts or hints because that would show disregard for a particular case. And she also said you can't display disdain or it would display disdain for the entire judicial process. You testified that you have not made any promises to anyone about how you might rule on a case that might come before you. That's because you know that a judicial nominee should never promise votes in exchange for a president's nomination or a senator's support. Moreover, we saw yesterday, and to some extent Monday, Democrat strategy continues to be to use scare tactics, distortions, and speculation. They're framing you as a real threat to health care coverage, and especially protections for existing conditions. This is all a charade. Just because of your comment, I believe just from one law review article you wrote critiquing Chief Justice Roberts' reasoning. So it's time to get real. This is all just a distraction. This is what we saw Monday and Tuesday. Democrats want to distract from the fact that they don't really care about Obamacare. You heard that since Democrats started their presidential primaries probably about 2 years ago. They want government-run health, Medicare for all. That's what you heard in the Democrat primary. The changes they seek to the ACA move America closer to a single-payer system where the government provides or subsidizes health care for all Americans, which we know eventually leads to government rationing of health care. Democrats want to distract from the fact that they just filibustered a COVID relief bill that would have protected pre-existing conditions. Next Monday, we'll see if they'll vote for a COVID recovery bill that Leader McConnell has scheduled for a vote next week. Democrats want to distract from the fact that Republicans, yes, Republicans, have introduced bills to protect Americans with pre-existing conditions and to bring down drug prices. And if we act, they don't have to worry about you doing away with pre-existing conditions in some future case down the road. In fact, given the opportunity to advance bipartisan Prescription Drug Pricing Reduction Act, that's the Grassley-Wyden bill, Democrats at Schumer's command walked away because they wanted an election year issue. Republicans passed and signed into law bills to end pharmacy gag clauses and to end abusive drug tactics that prevent lower-cost generic drugs from coming to market. Democrats want to distract from the fact that President Trump and the administration have taken steps to help lower health care costs for Americans, including finalizing a rule to allow the importation of prescription drugs from Canada and proposing a rule to facilitate the purchase of affordable insulin and EpiPen for lower income Americans. The president has signed an executive order to end surprise billing. Further, I and other Republicans have been working with the administration to increase transparency in drug prices, to step up enforcement of anti-competitive activity and prosecution of bad actors in the healthcare industry, and to improve and expedite regulatory approval of drugs to combat COVID and other diseases. Here is the bottom line of what we've all heard Monday and Tuesday. The Democrats cry foul over anything that may help Americans if it doesn't advance their agenda for Medicare for all. And the American people deserve to be reminded of this hearing, what it's all about. It's all about your qualifications to be on the Supreme Court. It's not about health care advocacy. Finally, Judge, Democrats want to distract from the fact that you're eminently qualified for this position you've been nominated for. And they don't like it that you know that the place of the courts is not to rewrite laws as you might see fit there. Here's the bottom line. I've asked you yesterday if it's your agenda to repeal the Affordable Care Act. You said, quote unquote, absolutely not. You said you've never made a commitment to anyone on the Affordable Care Act or on any matter. You've never been asked to make such a commitment. And you made very clear you would never make such a commitment. Mr. Chairman, I want to put some letters in the record from state legislative leaders supporting this nominee.
Without objection.
Now, you won't get away with asking some questions on some things that I'm very interested in. I'd like to discuss a law that I brought up with you when we talked for a short period of time, one-on-one. We didn't discuss it at that time, the False Claims Act. In 1986, we passed legislation that I drafted to make False Claims Act an effective tool to combat fraud against federal programs. This law enlisted the help of private citizens to enforce the False Claims Act through QI-TAM lawsuits. In 2000, the Supreme Court deemed the False Claims QI-TAM provisions constitutional. As you know, the False Claims Act has emerged as the government's primary weapon against fraud. Since we restored the law in 1986, False Claims actions have recovered $68 billion. Of taxpayers' money fraudulently taken, with $50 billion coming from whistleblower-initiated actions. Congress has remained vigilant to protect the False Claims Act from attempts to weaken it in the courts. Have you ever written or spoken publicly about the constitutionality of QI-TAM or any other provisions of the False Claims Act? And if so, what were the circumstances or the context?
Senator Grassley, I don't recall ever speaking about the False Claims Act or the constitutionality of the QI-TAM provisions or any other part of the act. So I can't think of a time when I have.
Do you have any preconceived ideas about the False Claims Act or Whistleblower Protection Act that would impact your ability to impartially decide any cases involving those issues?
I do not. Any case involving that act, I would approach with an open mind as with any other.
Some opponents of the False Claims Act argue that QI-TAM provisions are unconstitutional under Article 2 and 3. Are you familiar with these legal arguments? And if so, do you have an opinion on them?
Are you talking about the QI-TAM challenges?
Yeah.
Well, those aren't ones that I can express an opinion on because, as you say, they've been up before the court.
Another interest of mine that are probably at 87 years of age won't live long enough to see done, but I've discussed cameras in the courtroom and introduced legislation on that over the last 15 years. It's not a very popular subject. Judge Souter joked that he'd have to roll over in his dead body before they'd put cameras on the Supreme Court. While I can respect that point of view, I totally disagree. Many of us believe that allowing cameras in the courtroom would open the courts to the public and bring about a better understanding of the judiciary. For many years, that bill that I've introduced has been called the Sunshine in the Courtroom Act, a bill to give judges the discretion to allow media coverage of federal court proceedings. I'm also a co-sponsor of Senator Durbin's bill to allow cameras in the Supreme Court. I understand that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, where you currently serve, adopted procedures to allow requests for video recording of oral arguments as well as public release of the recordings.
That's correct.
Has your court had any problems with these procedures? What are your views on allowing cameras in the courtroom? If confirmed, Would you keep an open mind about allowing cameras in the Supreme Court?
I would certainly keep an open mind about allowing cameras in the Supreme Court.
I always ask people, district, circuit, or Supreme Court, this question about international law. I'd like to get your views on how and when you would apply international law to your decision-making process. Is it ever appropriate to cite international law when interpreting the U.S. Constitution?
Well, I would never want to say never, because it's certainly possible. Generally speaking, so it's been applied in the issues with which foreign law has been applied, and there's a debate about it, are when we're trying, or when the court is trying, or lower court is trying, to identify what is the nature of a right that's part of the tradition of the people, or that the people, like, what would the people view? And in my view, the United States Constitution is a compact, and it's the fundamental law of the American people. And so I don't think it would be controlled by the laws passed by other countries, because it reflects the fundamental commitments that we as an American people have made.
Thank you very much. I reserve my time.
Senator Durbin.
Senator Lee.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize, Senator Lee.
Out of sight, out of mind. I apologize.
This is Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, a Democrat, and he's speaking from a remote location.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes, sir. Loud and clear.
It, incidentally, for those who are watching and think that we may be polarized in things, I listened to what Senator Grassley said about cameras in the courtroom. And, of course, I agree with him on that, and he knows I have supported that. I've also joined with him in a few of the False Claim Act improvements. So there are many areas in our committee where senators have worked together. And I would ask, Mr. Chairman, if I could, unanimous consent, a letter from 10 former federal judges who are opposed to the process of this nomination, along with letters of opposition to the nomination from People for the American Way, NARO, and 208 women lawyers, and that they be inserted in the record.
Without objection.
You have to assume somebody's going to hand you those letters. I can't quite reach from from my room here. Now, Judge Barrett, it's good to see you again. I commend your children. I'm sure this is fascinating, but I'm sure it's a long day. And I'm sure you probably felt the same way, but this is part of democracy, and it's important that we have these questions. Now, we're being told that no one could possibly know how you would rule in the latest Republican-led case to overturn the Affordable Care Act. But what we do know is that you criticized Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in NFIB versus Sebelius. You stated that, quote, Roberts pushed the ACA beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute. And then you praised the dissent in King versus Burwell. So it seems every time you've weighed in on the legality of the statute, you come to one conclusion: the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. Now, over the past 2 weeks, you provided this committee, all of us, with some 1,800 pages of your writings and speeches for us to review, and I have.
This is live special coverage of the Supreme Court confirmation hearing for Judge Amy Coney Barrett from NPR News.
Write or speak out in defense.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at 91.1 FM, Elkhorn at 101.7, Lake Geneva 103.3, and around the world at WGTD.org.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
I have a couple of things, I guess, that maybe might help shed some light on this question. One is that, of course, in both of those contexts, I was speaking as an academic. And as I mentioned yesterday, an academic serves a very different function than a judge. So an academic doesn't go through the judicial process, doesn't hear the case or controversy, have the litigants and the